Saturday, September 3rd, was that marvelous thing, a well-balanced day between work and relaxation. And the work began at a reasonable hour. We left the White House a little before 9 in the helicopter, started out from Andrews in a convair for Charleston, West Virginia. That airport is one of the most memorable I've ever been in. It seems to be the sliced off top of a mountain. You come in at a fast speed, the mountains all around you, and there is the strip, safe below you, but very short it seems, and you put on the brakes hard, and you're very much aware that on each end it drops off into the steep wooded mountainsides. Governor Hewlett Smith and his wife and three children were at the foot of the steps with the reception committee, and one daughter had an enormous bouquet of rhododendron in September. I took a second look. They were rhododendron leaves, all right. But the blossom were wired on gladioli. Just a gay joke, because West Virginia is so much the land of rhododendron. There was the usual airport routine. A crowd of 6,000 to 8,000, bending, shaking hands all along the fence, eye going in another direction. Signs, many handmade, a group of Job Corps girls in navy blue uniforms, loud school bands. And then we were off in the helicopter. Governor and Mrs. Hewlett Smith and Senator Jennings Randolph and two congressmen over some of the most beautiful scenery in this whole country and a most vivid display of what we are doing to it with strip mining on the mountainsides. It's just as though some heedless child had been turned loose with a giant crayon on an enormous mural of forested hillsides and soft green valleys with creeks. The broad, ugly scars of the strip mining laid bare the hillsides, crawling around the mountains and on into the distance. Ugly, brutal, dramatic. I asked Mrs. Smith if there was any state legislation requiring the mine owners to reforest them or restore them anyway. Yes, that's the business on the agenda. It involves mostly some sort of terracing because there being an erosion problem. Then we reached the dam Lennon was going to dedicate in what was called the Somersville speech, though the community of Somersville was some miles away. It's a $46 million flood control dam, the largest earth and rock structure of its kind east of the Mississippi, nestling in one of the myriad valleys of the Appalachians, recently finished and still quite raw-looking, but already backing up a deep, clear body of water, which winds into numberless inlets and coves and bays. There are several thousand people in holiday mood, assembled from Lord knows where in this very rural country, as a part of their holiday weekend. Lyndon's speech was quite properly on water, a prediction of what our need for it would be in the year 2000. Our resources must be expanded many times over, because our present global population of 3 billion will have doubled by then. He announced the United States will sponsor an international conference on water for peace in Washington next May. Delegates from 100 countries will be invited, including the Soviet Union and many other communist nations. Two delightful moments about the day for me were to find that the mayor of Somersville was the younger brother of our Mr. Trafees Bryant, the electrician who tends to the dogs. And second, to hear the Army engineer in charge describe their predicament about naming this dam. They're usually named from the nearest post office, he said. But unfortunately, the closest small community was named Gad, G-A-D. And he couldn't quite see naming it Gad Dam, West Virginia. As we flew back in the helicopter, I looked down and saw on one of the little inlets a blanket spread on the grass close to the water, a small fire going, where two grown people were apparently cooking something, and children scattering all over. Summertime recreation like this is one of the byproducts, a very happy one, of such a great and purposeful structure. On the conveyor, we had a light lunch. One of the amazing things about a trip like this is how hungry you get. Somehow it consumes an enormous amount of energy to walk among thousands of people, smiling, shaking hands, trying to think of something pleasant to say that's worth their remembering. I'm always ravenous. We were at the Harrisburg, York airport on time, about 1:20. What a day. Governor and Mrs. Scranton met us. I like them both enormously. Their being Republicans somehow is no barrier whatever. And former governor leader, a long line of office holders, a great roaring fence full of welcomers. Whether billed or not, there's always an airport speech. if only a few minutes impromptu. And then began one of the most delightful parts of the day, a 30-mile motorcade. I rode with Mrs. Scranton, Mrs. Crayley, the wife of the congressman, whom Lyndon hopes to help, and Governor Leader, across some beautiful Pennsylvania countryside. They're lush and green to my southwestern eyes, in spite of the drought that's covered this whole eastern country. Rich, carefully tended farms. This isn't quite the Amish country, but it's close by, and they told me interesting tales of them. They have no electricity, no TV. They use the simplest farm tools. They've had some difficulty integrating them into the regular schools of this country because they don't believe in sending children to school beyond 12 years of age. They wear beards and bonnets and old-fashioned clothes and, needless to say, no makeup. And remarkably enough, they have very little revolt among the young. And very rich, very productive farms. The secret? They work hard. The Dallas Town speech was a centennial, and it was a perfect picture. Ladies in sunbonnets and calico, and men with beards, and everybody with smiles. The atmosphere, small town, gay, holiday, everybody ready to enjoy the afternoon. And I felt that our whole party was at once in tune with the mood and the place. I know I am always happier, more at ease, in a rural or small town setting. The presence of a few pickets protesting the war in Vietnam by no means distracted us. And the crowd roared, and Lyndon suggested that we all look at our country and count our blessings and think if there was any other country anywhere else that we'd rather be a part of. He had a prepared text, and appropriately enough, it was on cities, saying that too many Americans are compelled to leave farms and small towns where they prefer to live to find employment in the overcrowded cities. They go seeking opportunity, a brighter future. But it doesn't have to happen, he said. Modern industry and modern technology and modern transportation can bring jobs to the countryside rather than people to the cities, and modern government can help. Does it really make sense to have 70% of our people crammed into 1% of the land? We must make better use of the 99% of this continent which lies outside the cities. We must ask more from and give to communities like your own. The problem of cities, urgent as it is, has been beating at our door so insistently these last few months. I was glad of a different voice for a change. The whole 99% of the rest of the country, where I find it so much pleasanter to live. But he was soon off of his prepared text and just talking. They loved it. He loved it. And even I, when I got up to say a few words, did rather well. I'd spoken about 3 times at our 4 stops. And felt that it was probably a bit of a plus, at least all right. We left Dallas Town not more than 30 minutes late and motorcaded back to the Harrisburg, York Airport and were in Washington by 4:30. Just time for me to have 2 quick games of bowling, Marianne Reardon, who had gone along with us on the trip. I reach for a different sort of exercising when I've gone on one of these journeys. 15 and 119. And then our guests began to arrive for the boat ride. The Bill Whites and the Jack Valentes and Emmett Reardon and the Larry O'Briens and Senator McCarthy without Abigail, who's home recuperating, and Bob Kintner, a summer bachelor, and the Tom Manns, Marie and her date, and Florence Mahoney. It was an early evening on the Sequoia, and what a delightful place to be with the heat pressing down on the city and the river offering at least the appearance of cool and certainly the joy of a long and lovely view. Tom Mann looked happier and more relaxed than I've ever seen him. Private life agrees with him. He's writing a book on our foreign policy, particularly as it relates to Latin America. I shall look forward to reading it. It will no doubt be cut to pieces by our liberal press. He's a rare man, and I'm glad we had him in federal service. And I suppose I understand the necessity for him leaving. Sheer weariness, many years, the need to make money. June White gave an exciting account of Alan Drury's new book. Larry O'Brien and I talked about the Karnak Post Office. And Florence told me about Mary's life. Her first husband, her stepchildren, her early years. A fascinating story. It was a quiet, low-key evening that ended early, and we were back at the White House before 10. Time for me, oh luxury of luxuries, to see Gunsmoke, and it was not a repeat. I valiantly did my exercises. If there has been a week of routine in my life, it has been this one. Exercise, walking, fairly earnest dieting, either swimming or bowling about 5 days out of the last seven. The spirit of New Year's resolution of starting again, which I inaugurated right after Lucy's wedding, may be short-lived, but at least it's in full swing now. And then I cozily settled with a little Dubonnet for a massage and watching the rest of Gunsmoke. My idea of the ultimate in self-indulgence to wind up the day.